Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I'm glad you're with us. Every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, we stream live at richarddugan.com. The radio show's page is where we keep the archives. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We're rebroadcast at azen.fm, and we are really excited to have you with us. I am really enjoying doing these broadcasts, and for darn near 7 years, seems unbelievable that we've been doing these programs for that long, but then again, it seems pretty unbelievable that I've been in this business for over 33 years and counting. And I've joked with a lot of people, and maybe it may come to pass that I have no plans of retiring. The only retiring I'm going to do is if my car needs a new set of tires, I will retire the car, but I have no plans. Because they're going to have to peel my cold, dead carcass from the console the day I die. That's just kind of the way I feel about it, that there's no reason to stop doing what you love doing. And I hope that you have found that which you love doing. I know one gentleman who has is my guest, and he is a rabbi. I know that you have to love being a rabbi because of the level of education and study that it takes, and especially when it comes to writing a book, and a book of this type. The Real Name of God is the title of the book, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. Rabbi Wayne Dossick, PhD, thank you so much for joining us on the program. I am really looking forward to the next hour or so.
Well, it's a great, great pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me. And I want you to know that I was on a television program at your local Santa Barbara cable station with Fred Klein. And he's, I'm sure, much older than you are, and he's still at it. So you go at it for as long as you want.
Like I said, I'll be talking like this, and a little waver in the voice, but we'll still be chatting away about the fun things that are going on in this world. And, of course, we are kind of talking about new paradigms. And yet, at the same time, I have to say that this conversation is one that I actually had back, believe it or not, back in the 80s, the 1980s, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, and it had to do with the fact that I was working at that time, and I did for 15 years, worked for a Christian radio station, and into the station one day walked a group of people who wanted to buy some time to broadcast a program to talk about the fact that we should be using the real name, the true name of God. Now, I remember hearing that it was impossible for us to speak the name, the real name of God, because, number one, it was unpronounceable, and number two, it wasn't to be spoken, almost along the lines of the Harry Potter movies where you're not supposed to say the name Voldemort. A different context, granted, but still the same general rule. And, of course, their premise was that, no, you can certainly speak the name, but you want to make sure it's the right name. And from their perspective, the name was Yahweh. I thought, well, that's not so hard to say. But you have written this book called The Real Name of God. And I know that this is a conversation I'm sure you've had that you discuss in the book as well. I'm just going to go, we'll just start from the beginning. What is the real name of God?
Well, the first issue is, why does God have so many names? So that was my first question. How does the all-perfect God, the one all-perfect God, have so many names? Judaism has 20, 30, 40 names for God. Christianity, Islam, the Hindus have 99 names. Some say 999 names for God. So how could the all-perfect God have so many names? And my second question was, how does the all-perfect God of love, who loves me, who has compassion, who gives us a sterling set of rules to live by for the highest moral conduct between human beings, how does that one perfect God often behave so badly in the Bible, harsh, angry, militant, vengeful, revengeful, male, domineering, authoritarian? That's not the God of love I know.
Yeah.
And so I said to myself, there has to be an answer to this question. And the answer is that none of the names that we have forgotten, not even Yahweh, which is the way scholars pronounce Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which Jews call Adonai, the main God of the Hebrew Bible, none of the names that we have forgotten is God's real name. Each one is an attribute or an aspect or a manifestation or a characteristic of God, but none is the whole, complete totality of God. So if you picture a beach ball, all the colored panels of the beach ball, each one is one of the names of God, which represents one of the aspects or attributes. My question was, what is the name of the divine beach ball? The whole God. Could I go back into the Bible itself and find it hiding in plain sight for all these years, just waiting for the right energetic moment in time to be revealed? And I found it.
Now, I'm going to stop you there. You say you found it. I've had this conversation with non-religious as well as religious folks on this program as well, not in terms of the real name of God, but in terms of being able to truly know what the Word of God, whether it be the Old Testament, and in the case of the Jews is the Torah, and then there's the New Testament that, you know, the Christians ascribe to. And each of these books was written in a language that most of us in the United States of America probably either don't know, or even if we know that that's the case, we couldn't speak it. I know that the Old Testament, if I'm correct, you being a rabbi and having the extensive education I know that you must have, I know that the Old Testament was written originally, if I'm correct, in Hebrew. Is that right?
That's correct. So the Old Testament encompasses the Torah, the five books of Moses, mm-hmm. the prophets, and writings.
Okay.
So all of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and the earlier prophets in those prophetic books, Joshua and Judges and Kings and Samuel, and then all the major prophets and the minor prophets. And it also encompasses what we call writings, the Psalms and Proverbs and Job and Esther and Ruth, all of those things. That makes up what Christianity calls the Old Testament, what we call the Hebrew Bible. And yes, you're right, I do know Hebrew, and that's the good news, because I could go back into the Hebrew Bible itself and read the Hebrew in its original,
mm-hmm.
in order to confirm what, if you will, my guidance or my prayers or my meditations gave me. So when I ask God or ask Source or ask the beach ball, its real name,
right?
It gave me a name.
Okay, and we're going to get to that as
and
well.
And here's the good news.
Yes, the good news.
The good news is that Rabbi Google exists these days. More specifically, there's a Bible program called Accordance, so we should give them great credit. I put the word into the search engine, and it gave me all 359 times that the word is used in the Bible.
Wow.
141 times in the Torah, and 248 times in the rest of the Bible, a total of 359. And then because I do know Hebrew and I do know biblical text, I went and I studied each and every one of those 359 times, and that confirmed my idea.
Okay. Now, the New Testament, originally, from what I understand, was written in Aramaic. Now, this goes to my point. There's a passage in one of the epistles, and the passage basically goes like this, we will all be caught up to meet him in the air. Now, the operative word in this passage is air. I have a Strong's Concordance at home, and if we choose to take the position, for sake of argument, that both the New Testament that I'm reading from and the Concordance that I am researching in are they're accurate to the best of their ability, I went to that passage, I went to that word as it's shown in the Concordance, and it shows two definitions of the word air, A-I-R. First definition has to do with the air around us, that the clouds float through it and the birds fly and we look up into the sky, we see the sun and so on and so forth. Second definition has to do with basically, you can hone it down to this. God breathed the breath of life, or air, into the nostrils of Adam from the Old Testament, Genesis. Now, Christians today believe that that passage refers to a physical rapture where they will be caught up to meet the Messiah in the sky. Yet my Strong's Concordance says it's the second definition. So there's where our first problem lies. And I'm not getting into specifics with this passage. Has to do with how we are losing so much when it comes to translation from the original languages into, whether it was into the Greek or the Italian or the French or whatever the case may be, or even into English. Hebrew, I know enough about Hebrew, Rabbi, that I know that each letter in the alphabet of the 22 characters has its own, shall we say, vibration or musical tone, numerical ranking, if you will, its own legend. Then when you start putting these letters together into words, it creates something totally new and different. And you start putting those words into sentences, the same thing, transformation happens. Sentences into paragraphs, the same exponential transformation happens. So how is it possible for us, as, I'm going to say, uneducated or the unwashed, to truly know what God is telling us through these ancient writings, to be able to then find the true name of God?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that since this book has come out, I've done scores and scores of interviews, radio, television, newspaper, and this is the most scholarly interviewer, you, I've ever encountered. So first of all, congratulations to you.
Well, thank you.
Second of all, you ask 10, 12 questions all at once. So let me just try to sort out a little bit of it. First of all, you are absolutely right in the issue of translation. The issue of translation is that the New Testament particularly went from its Aramaic writings to Greek, the Septuagint, to Vulgate, the Latin, eventually to King James, which was, I think, 1611 in English. And if you go to a bookshelf now, there are probably 20, 30, 40 good English translations of the Bible, many of which differ with each other. That's why there's more than one. So the issue of translation is difficult. When I put out the book with the name of God, a few weeks later, I got a email from a pastor in upstate New York. He says to me, "Can you help me? I think, I've read and studied your book very carefully, I think that the name that you have identified is in the Gospel of John. Can you help me?" And I wrote back and I said, "I'm sorry, I can't, because I don't read either Greek nor Latin, and I can't help with the reading of the original." And 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, he wrote back and said, "I've spent all my spare time studying this, and I am absolutely convinced that the name you've identified from the Hebrew Bible is in the Gospel of John." So that's sort of an outside confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
The real issue is inside the text, not so much the translations. And, you know, I mean, take exactly the example that you gave us. The second definition of air, is, and I've not studied this at all, so I'm just responding.
Mm-hmm.
The second definition of air is the breath of life given to Adam.
Mm-hmm.
That is the biblical account. The interpretation of that, that will be the rapture in the air, which is Christianity's theology and cosmology, that's not in the text. That's the leap that the interpreters take.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to differentiate between text and its definitions and its translations and interpretation.
Yeah.
Now, what makes my discovery, and again, I didn't make this up, I just found it. What makes my discovery different from anything else is that all the names that we have for God are given by human beings. So anything that's post-Torah is a name assigned by, given by, defined by a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I went back into the text itself and found the name that was there in the original. So, let me tell you the name and tell you how it works.
Okay.
The real name of God is Anochi. It's one of those words.
Right.
Anochi is like Hanukkah or Challah, or if you don't have the Jewish, then you can say Johann Sebastian Bach.
There you go.
The same thing, same guttural sound. Anochi is usually translated as I. But Hebrew has another word for I, which is the small I, the small self, the ego self. This I is the fullness, the completeness, the totality. And so every time it is used in the Bible, in the voice of God, it is when the full totality, the full essence, the wholeness of God, not any one aspect or any one attribute or any one colored panel of the divine beach ball, is sufficient to the teaching or to the event. It is also used in the voice of human beings. When a human being is saying, how do I come into the fullness of my God self, of God within me, that breath of air that is God within me, that is God within me. No, we're not God, but we are of God.
Mm-hmm.
And a human being asks that, and, for example, am I my brother's keeper? Says, asks Cain. He's asking, he didn't know about death. He didn't know about what his responsibility on earth was. He didn't know that pushing his brother or hitting him with a stone would result in his ceasing to be. So he's asking, what is my responsibility as a human being? Am I responsible for anything other than myself? How does my God self, the God within me, teach me how to be as godlike as possible? So it's used both in the voice of human beings and certainly in the voice of God when it is most vital to the event or to the teaching. And it's therefore time after time after time after time, all 359 times where the word is used, it is one of those vital spaces. And the sages throughout Jewish history knew, and some of them left us hints in their writings. In Jewish sacred literature, the Midrash, and in the Talmud, and in the Zohar, the Book of Mysticism, and one of the Hasidic rabbis, the Ishbitzer Rebbe, they all knew. They left us hints in their writings. I translate all of them and put them into the footnotes in the back of the book. And it just wasn't the right energetic moment in time for them to tell. So it's not just that I found it, but I found confirmation of it throughout history.
Many times on this program, I will ask, like I did with you just a moment ago, a series of 13 questions all in one. And you will sort of answer the next question that I'm about to ask, but I'm still going to ask it because I want you to address it specifically.
Okay.
Why is it so important that we, A, know the true name of God, and of what impact does it really have on our individual, personal, daily lives to use it?
Oh.
And how would we use it? And there's another three questions.
Thank you so much. It's a perfect question, and I really didn't answer it in my previous answer, so I'm so glad you asked it.
Okay.
If you hadn't asked it, I would have told you somewhere along the way.
I'm sure you would have. Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So here it goes. This discovery, I believe, gives us four world-changing, what I call reformations. Number one, Anochi is a genderless word, or better, it's genderful. So it eliminates for us the problem of calling God he, she, or it. We can call God simply Anochi. And we don't have to, now English and Hebrew both have the gender problem in nouns and verbs.
Yeah.
I haven't figured that out yet. I'm not a linguist. But somewhere along the line, we know that God is the everything of the everything, the whole, complete, divine beach ball. And what does that mean? It means that it's our recognition that God, the wholeness of God, is both male and female, right and wrong, good and evil, justice and mercy. So it means that if God is the everything of the everything, we who are created in God's image reflect God. We hold within us the everything of the everything. And so Jung understood this 100 years ago when he talked about the archetypes within.
Mm.
And so what God says to us is, here's my panel of good, here's my panel of evil. It's all part of me, and it's all part of you. Please, my children, choose my panel of good far more than you choose to reflect my panel of evil. And when bad guys reflect my panel of evil, use your good to overcome them. That's number one, and that's incredibly important.
Yes.
Number two is that it reminds us that there is the transcendent God of creation and history, and there is the immanent God, the God within, of breath and soul. And so we are very good, all the religious and faith communities are very good at creating rituals and observances and beliefs for a communal covenant with God. And each one is different, but each one is ultimately the same. It's the way a faith community comes to God. This discovery reminds us also that each and every one of us can have a deep, personal, intimate, loving relationship with God. So it is the personal covenant as well as the communal covenant. Number three, it tells us that the harsh, angry, vengeful, revengeful God that so many get stuck on theologically is only one aspect of the God. It's not the whole God. It's not the everything of God. It's one part of God. And so those who get stuck on that part now can know that there are many, 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 many other panels. Just as God has an angry panel, God also has a deeply compassionate and deeply loving panel. And finally, and this is probably most important, and why this revelation has come at this point in history, the theme song of the world these days seems to be, "My God's better than your God."
Yes.
And if you don't believe me, I will become a fundamentalist to teach you this. And if you don't believe that, I will become an extremist. And if you don't believe me in my extremeness, I will become a militant,
yeah,
a radical militant. And if you don't believe that, I will become a terrorist, and I will terrorize you into submission to believe the way I believe.
Yeah.
And what this tells us is there is one God called by many different names,
mm-hmm,
just as, for example, in families, in some families, the siblings call the parents by different names. One says father, one says daddy, one says pops,
mm-hmm,
one says mommy, one says mama, one says mother. Same parents, same children, just different names. So we all can call God whatever we want to call God. If you want to call God now Anochi, please do. You're happy with what you're calling God in your faith community? Please do. But remember this, it's one God in one world, and we are all God's children. And so God is saying to us, I love you all, my children. I am a God of love. I love you all. I don't care what you call me. I don't care how you address me. I don't care how you worship me or talk to me. I am the God of you all. I love you all equally. I don't play any favorites amongst my children. And my hope and desire for you is, as I love you, I would like you to love me, and then love each other. This is a world not of sameness, but of oneness. It is a world of oneness where we all are children of the one God who loves us all and tells us to love each other. And why at this exact moment in time? Because with all our technological and scientific prowess, we have the ability that no generation has ever had before, and that is either we are going to learn to live together in unity and harmony and tranquility and peace, or we will destroy each other and perish from this earth.
And they say that that has happened. I've had guests on this program who've said that's happened at least four times on this planet, but that's a subject for another program. I have to say that there is a sort of a joke in there somewhere that, can I say Mr. Anokhi? And the response would be, no, that's my father. Well,
or you could say Ms. Anokhi.
Exactly.
However you like.
Or depending upon your upbringing and your religious faith, I only refer to him as Sir.
Sir. for Jews particularly, we say many, many blessings a day. We bless God over the food we eat, over all the things. But the core rubric of that blessing is dresses God as the king of the universe. And I don't like that masculine designation only, because it's only one part of God. So for Jews, I rewrote the blessings calling God the source of all worlds and the breath of all living beings, who gives us food, who keeps us in life, who blesses us in many, many ways. Now, a colleague, a friend of mine said, like anything else, said to me, people will get the designation of Anochi, but it'll take 100 years for them to change the blessings, because ritual is deeply, deeply embedded, and it's a deep touchstone, and you just don't, the things you learn from birth, basically, you just don't change overnight.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
And, of course, there is, I was speaking in one audience, and some man raised his hand, stood up, and he said, Rabbi, I want you to know, I think you're a visionary genius. What you have found here is going to change the world profoundly for good. I said, thank you very much. I said, my late parents would be very pleased. Thank you. And another woman stood up and said, you are a blasphemer.
Well, there you go, the two different attributes of God.
Right. And like anything else, anytime you challenge long-held, comfortable beliefs, it's scary. And the fear leads to deeper fear and to anger and all those things. I understand. I don't expect the world to change overnight. But it is the beginning of telling the world of the one God who is the God of us all, who is the God of love.
The interesting thing about these cards, now you actually have, at least in my edition of the book, there were two little bookmarks, I'll call them. And on one side, it talks about the book, The Real Name of God, Rabbi Wayne Dosick, PhD, blah, blah, blah. Other side, it has the three forms. One of them is in, I'll say, English, the Anochi, A-N-O-C-H-I.
So that's what we call the transliteration, that is taking the Hebrew and putting it into English characters.
And then at the bottom, it has the letter I.
Mm-hmm.
But at the top, it's in Hebrew. Now, help me along here. Are there three or four characters that I'm looking at?
Four.
Okay. Now, the one that strikes me fascinating, and I don't know what these characters represent in the alphabet. All I know is that's what they are, is the third character that has the four spikes going up. And the first thing I thought of when I saw that was royalty, king.
Hmm.
That was the first thing I thought of in that third character. What is that character?
Well, it's the Hebrew letter Nun. And actually, I don't want to disappoint you, but this is Torah script. Instead of using a font of a regular font like the Hebrew equivalent of Times or whatever, we put it into the way it looks handwritten in Torah.
Okay.
And handwritten in Torah, there are a number of letters that have decorations just to make them look pretty.
Kind of like, I'm trying to think of calligraphy.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
The interesting thing about this is that, you mentioned it early, numerical value. If you add up the numerical value, we call it in Hebrew gematria, which is the use of numbers to represent letters. If you add it up, it comes to 81. 81 is a 9 in universal numerology.
Mm-hmm.
9 is the number of wholeness and completeness.
Mm.
So the number itself, and if you reverse the numbers, it becomes 1-8, which is, of course, also 9. 1-8 is, in gematria, the equivalent of the Hebrew word chai, as in to life, l'chaim, which is life. And so it's our life in the perfect completeness, the wholeness of God.
This, I have to say that I have had just incredible conversations over the last year with two or three different rabbis. I don't know, maybe I should have been born into a Jewish family, I don't know, but I have just been so fascinated by the conversation that I have had, especially when we start getting into a few of the specifics here and there. And this is, honestly, this is no exception, and I am not blowing wind up your yarmulke. We're going to take
a
quick break.
One of your Santa Barbara rabbis is a very dear friend of mine, and the other, whom I don't know quite as well, I spoke at his synagogue in the fall. So, and I was there also at Chaucer's. I love Santa Barbara, as you know. And if those are the two rabbis that you spoke to, they have my highest regard.
Well, I make this invitation to you now before we even get anywhere near the end of our program, and that is the next time you're in Santa Barbara, let's sit down in studio and we'll talk face-to-face. I think that we'd have a great time as well. I'm going to let our listeners know before we go to break that the book is entitled The Real Name of God. The author is my guest, Rabbi Wayne Dossick, Ph.D., and certainly you can pick it up at any bookstore. You can go online, and we are going to give you the web address here in just a couple of minutes here, but first we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. My guest is the author of The Real Name of God. He is Rabbi Wayne Dossick. And this is, as I said at the outset, just it's a fascinating conversation, I think, because it opens you up, I think, to, as an individual listening to this program, it opens you up to information. Maybe you've heard it before. I don't know. But what I can say is that there is no hidden agenda here. I don't get that from you, Wayne, or Rabbi, because it's like what we're trying to do. What we'd set out on our table every week is a smorgasbord. You come to the table, you take what you like, and you leave the rest. We're not asking you to take it all, but we are asking you to consider it. And normally I make this, I say disclaimer or warning at the end of the program, because I always find it's so much more interesting when people hear it at the end of the program. But I'll make the warning now. It is so important to be careful what you take in through your five senses, what you eat, what you drink, but even more so what you listen to. I know that you would agree with me, Rabbi, that words have power. And so when you are choosing to listen to something, whether it be a television program, music, a play, theater, or even this program, once you've heard it, it's too late. Now you have to deal with it. Now, if you're intrigued by what we're talking about, I encourage you to stay tuned, because I have no idea where this is going. The universe asks the questions, Rabbi. I'm just along for the ride, okay?
Me too.
Now, the website, because I mentioned this before, that I have listed here is godisanochi.com. That's GODISANOCHI.com. And people can get more information there as well. But they can they also email you? I have this email address that I can give out.
Sure.
It's WDOSICK at gmail.com. Basically, that's Wayne Dossick, but WDossick at gmail.com. If you would like to express any of the attributes of God in your conversation, in your email with the rabbi, we encourage you to do so. I'd like to hear from you, too, to find out what you think about this program and this conversation. As I said, it's always been interesting to delve into these subjects, because I was told, Rabbi, when I was working for this religious station, that by some of the programmers, that I just needed to go and read the writings of the founding fathers of the faith. And I thought, well, wait a minute. First of all, a lot of them I had never heard of at that time. I had never heard of them before. And who set them up as the founding fathers? Who set them up as the arbiters of the faith? Who set them up to make the determination as to what would and would not be in what we have today as the 66 books of the Bible? Because I know there are other writings. And as a matter of fact, I know you know that there are other writings that are being discovered even as we speak that have been buried for centuries. And yet, if it smacks in any way, shape, or form contrary to what the orthodox position is, oh no, that's blasphemy. That you can't go there. I mean, I don't understand why, for example, in the Catholic Bible, I was born and raised Catholic, I don't think the book of Malachi is in the 66 books, but it's in the Catholic Bible or some of the others. I mean, I think there are 69 overall in the Catholic Bible. There are only 66 in the Protestant. I always found that kind of odd. I thought there was some uniformity here. But when it comes to the name of God, I always found that as an interesting conversation as well, just as you brought up at the beginning of our program, from the different religions, you know, and of course, I'm familiar with, of course, the Eastern Indian fact that there are 99 or 999 names. But I mean, I've always thought of those, again, as you described, as attributes. And by the way, my God is a soccer ball, not a beach ball. I want you to know that.
Or a Coke bottle.
Or a Coke. Hey, whatever you want. how did you get started in all of this? I mean, this is not every week, I'm sure that you give the equivalent, I'm sure, of a homily at Temple, a message. Mm-hmm. But this is one that it's like, man, you could talk about this for days.
Well, you know, my priest, every rabbi should have a priest.
Yes.
My priest says that this, he's over 80 years old. He's been a priest for more than 50 years. He's a devoted, devoted spiritual man. Actually, I was rooting for him to be Pope, but his name is Father James J. O'Leary. We fondly call him J.J., so I was rooting for Pope J.J. the First.
I love it.
And he said he'd give me a red yarmulke and bring me to the Vatican as a major advisor. So you notice the new Pope hasn't called me yet.
No, not yet.
Right.
He will.
Right. What Father O'Leary says is that this gives him a much greater understanding of the Trinity, because the Trinity is something I never understood.
Yeah.
One God, one and three and one. I don't understand it. Well, it makes sense now. It's three faces of the one God.
Yeah, yeah.
So a priest understands the Trinity better, and he no longer has to say, oh, it's a mystery. I just want to comment about the power of words. I wrote a book a long time ago called Golden Rules, the 10 Ethical Values Parents Need to Teach Their Children. And as I was talking to people about what would go into that book, somebody reminded me, one child can hear, I love you, I love you, I love you, and another child can hear, you're the stupidest kid in the entire world. And that stays. That stays.
Yeah.
My mother came home once from high school. Embarrassingly, she was the president of the high school PTA. Can you think of anything more embarrassing for a 15-year-old boy?
Oh.
So she comes home and she says, I met your chemistry teacher in the hall. And she said to me, Mrs. Dossick, I'm sorry to tell you, I don't think Wayne will ever amount to anything. He can't or won't memorize the periodic table of elements. So my mother said, is this true? And I said, of course it's true. She said, why didn't you memorize the periodic table? I said, look, I'm only 15, but I realize there's no place for the hard sciences in my life, and why take up brain space?
Believe it or not, I learned the periodic table in eighth grade, and that got me on the bus to go to Disneyland.
that would have done it. So there I am. So you can imagine in a Jewish household, we had the Wayne will learn the periodic table blitz weekend, and by Monday I knew the periodic table. But can you imagine what would have happened if I had had less of an ego, if I had had less self-confidence?
Mm.
Her statement, Wayne will never amount to anything, could have become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes, yeah.
And so words are incredibly important. You're right.
Yeah.
And, And I hope you continue to emphasize that on your program.
Well, the one paradox that I have always been faced with, especially working for news talk stations and during election cycles, but I came to this conclusion back in the 80s. When I first started, I started to listen to what was being said by the various parties, whoever was, you know, running a candidate on the, in the primaries, you know, the very beginnings. And I started listening to things that were being said. And I thought, wait a minute, something's wrong here. And so I came up – this is the way I phrased this and to reinforce this, you know, that in the primaries, okay, things are said. Words are said against the other candidate so that you can get elected and so on and so forth. Then the election is held and there's a winner. And the winner says, okay, let's all now join together to go after the other guy on the other side in the general. And the same process unfolds for 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever the case may be. And then the election is held and then the winner comes out and says, okay, now let us all join hands and sing Kumbaya. And I sat there going, wait a minute. But what about the things you said about the other guy? How can you honestly say those things and then turn right around and say, oh, well, wait a minute. This is just politics. And I would say, no, it's not. If you didn't mean what you said about that guy during the primary or during the general campaign, if you didn't mean it, then why did you say it? And if you didn't mean that and you're chalking it up to politics, then what makes you think I'm going to believe you now that you're an office holder when you tell me things?
Well, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. I spent half my life on pro-civil rights picket lines and work, and the other half of my life on anti-war picket lines. And my original career plan was I was going to be governor of Illinois, senator from Illinois, and president of the United States. And the day Bobby Kennedy was killed, I went to the dean of the rabbinical school and said, activate my application. I knew that I couldn't do it in the streets anymore because there wasn't truth in the streets.
Yeah.
And so this is the way that I've done it. And you asked earlier in one of your multitudinous questions, how did I come to this? I came to this because I gave my life, I devoted my life to God and the Jewish people and the Jewish land. And I, from the time I was a little kid, I sat in synagogue on Saturday mornings, listened to the Torah scroll being read, and said to myself, even as a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, there is something wrong here. There is a paradox. There is too much contradiction. It doesn't make sense that the God who loves me behaves this way, opens up the earth and swallows the enemy. How ridiculous. That's not the God I know, either from before or from now. And so while I addressed that God, I was always nagged by the inconsistencies with that God. And when I finally had the time and the energy and the effort and the I would say, spiritual maturity to be able to really explore this, that's what I did. And so, in the second half of the book, second half of The Real Name of God, it is filled with meditations and prayers and chants to help people, to guide people, to that deep, personal, intimate relationship with God. So there are more than 30 chants in the book, each one a different pathway, a different journeyway to come to God. Now, how can you hear chants in a book? You can't. So if you go to the website, www.godisanochi.com, G-O-D-I-S-A-N-O-C-H-I, there we have all 30 chants, and you can listen to them, as we used to say in the old South Side of Chicago, free for nothing. You can listen to them. Or if you want to have them as yours, you can purchase a download or purchase a CD.
Yeah.
There's also a companion booklet that's called The Care and Feeding of Your God Self, with more prayers, with more meditations, the chants all in order, things that we didn't have room for in the book. So you can do that. So you were speaking earlier of the breath of God mm-hmm. in Adam.
Yeah.
So one of the chants is the Hebrew word ruach. I know it's another one of those words. It's a hard one. But you can also say breathing because, I mean, have you ever been snorkeling?
I honestly have not.
All right, so when you I don't do it too much either. But when you snorkel, what do you hear? You hear your own breath. And particularly the Eastern religions, particularly Buddhism, tell us about mindful breathing. If we are mindful that each one of our breaths is the breath that God gave us that makes us alive. After all, what turns this lump of chemicals, it's you or me, worth probably a couple hundred bucks on the open market, what turns us into living, breathing, animated human beings? It is the breath of God within us.
Yeah.
And when God takes away that breath, we die and return to the dust. So if we chant the word breath, the breath of God, we become aware that God is within us. We are not God, we are of God. But if we are aware that God is within us, how godlike does that make us? So one of the chants is, ruach, you can even hear the whoosh, ruach, 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 breathing, 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 breathing. If you chant that and are aware that breathing is not to be taken for granted, but breathing is the breath of God within you, you can feel God within all the time.
In my research on that particular passage, and I will just kind of let you know that what I was doing was actually a research project on a book that I was going to be interviewing the author on.
Mm.
And he was a devout, born-again fundamentalist Christian who was asking some very serious and very profound questions because he felt that Christendom had been taking its people down a false path. And so he started digging into this stuff. Well, my purpose in the research was to make the information that he was revealing in his book mine. I didn't want to constantly say, let's say with your book, I didn't want to, oh, yeah, well, Rabbi Dossick says, who knows, you know, unless they know who you are. I went to the Bibles. I have multiple versions of the Bible, and I have a Strong's Concordance, and I could sit there and say, okay, can we, for the sake of argument, agree that these documents are legitimate, valid documents we can work from? Most people would say yes, and I'd say, okay, then from here we begin the conversation.
Well, I wouldn't quite say yes. I would say yes with a caveat.
Okay.
And that is that, with all due respect, Christianity, as far as I understand it and see it, particularly fundamentalist Christianity, freezes the Bible in time and place. And Judaism constantly interprets and reinterprets the Hebrew Bible. But more importantly even, we have to understand that the Bible is not simply a religious or theological document. And it's not simply even an historical document. It is a political, social, cultural document, particularly political. I'll just give you one example. The Hebrew Bible has nothing about life after death, nothing about a world to come.
Mm-hmm.
That idea comes into Judaism beginning in the rabbinic period about 200 before the Common Era and gets really big around the time of Jesus. Why? Why is it not anywhere in the Hebrew Bible, but then becomes big at a particular period of time? Well, think about the time period into which Judaism was born, or at least Torah Judaism was born. It was a time when the one book that we have extant from that period is the Egyptian Book of the Dead. So Egyptians had a great cult of ancestor worship. They would worship the ancestors who were on the other side, asking them to intervene with the deities in order to achieve the things that they wanted. Judaism comes around and says, we are monotheistic. We have one God, and we want to worship that one God. And the people of the time said, what do you mean one God? They got all those other gods over there. Writers of the Bible used the Torah as a political document. It had one candidate. The candidate was God, and it wanted God to be the one and recognized God. And so it cut out anything that had to do with any other kind of worship, that is, ancestor worship of the Egyptians, and concentrated on worship of God, who is the one God, and that's their candidate, and that's their electoral position. So we have to see it all in context, and we have to see it all then in its entire interpretation of how it plays out. We saw over the centuries that any kind of slavery was unacceptable, even though the Bible accepted some kinds of slavery. We saw in the rabbinic period how rabbis, the sages, the scholars of the time came up with a process to forgive to keep the loans, the debts that were incurred, to keep them alive during the seventh year instead of having them all canceled, so that farmers could continue to borrow money for their crops without the lender being afraid that he would lose all his money in the seventh year. There are all kinds of ways that the Bible is played with.
Mm-hmm.
And so in any discussion of the Bible, that's where I start.
Well, the thing that struck me, though, was in that passage that I quoted at the beginning of the program when we talked about the whole issue of translation and what's lost, was the fact that when I first discovered the definition in that passage in the New Testament, I didn't stop there. I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. And I looked at that word in the concordance, and I looked to the corollary words that it was also a part of. And it spoke to the words spirit, breath, life, and so on and so forth. All of those words have been used in this program thus far, and they all come – and I'm not saying they come from the definition, that one word in Aramaic in the concordance, but that when you start speaking about the soul, which was another word that it was related to – in the New Testament in particular, I just found that it was so interesting how all of these words are part of that whole. And, you know, it was as if I had opened the floodgates of discovery, that it wasn't just about inhale, exhale. There was more to it. And even going to what you were sharing, I had those same kinds of thoughts as a child. I used to think that this world in which you and I live today, it was all created for me personally, individually, and that I was sitting inside of this vehicle as if I, when I get into my Volvo and I put the key in the ignition and I turn on the car and I put it in the reverse to back out of the parking place and move about, that essence, which is me, that God has animated through that breath, is observing through the eyes and the ears and the other senses what's going on in this world, and that everybody is here for my benefit, not in an egotistical construct, but that this is my world and I need to take care of it or it won't be here for me. The book is entitled The Real Name of God. My guest has been Rabbi Wayne Dossick. Thank you once again for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
If you're just curious as to if there's more to this interview following the radio broadcast, there is. There is more following the A to Zen broadcast. So go to richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and listen to the entirety of this program. You're going to love it. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this time, love to Lal. And I need to take care of these other beings. I don't know if they think these same thoughts, that they're in this vehicle and they're watching me and observing and I'm here for their benefit. I wasn't there yet. I mean, again, I'm serious. I was thinking this as an 8 or 9 year old.
Mm-hmm. Well, the more we think that, the more people who think that way, the better off this world will become, because you will understand the world is here for you just as you are here for the world, and we are all children of the one God. And it's the way the Eastern religions say namaste. The God in me acknowledges the God in you. If that is the case, then I can't cheat you in business, because I would be diminishing your God self, I would be diminishing my God self, and I'd be diminishing God. Nor can I even get frustrated with you if you are the clerk, the teenage clerk in the convenience store who can't make change for a dollar bill without using a computer.
Yeah.
And you can be frustrated and angry until you realize that's a child of God, just the way you are a child of God.
Yeah.
And so one of the chants says, I place God before me always. And another one of the chants says, with grace, with covenantal love, and with compassion. So those are chants that if you sing and learn and use maybe as a daily spiritual practice, interestingly enough, when you're standing in line at the bank and the teller is taking forever, that chant will bubble up in your mind. And you will remind yourself that that clerk is a child of God just the way you are.
I have logged into your website, and I want to share with our listeners just one, just a portion of one of the chants from Anahi, and this is the chant, Joyous.
And you can connect with Anahi okay. In joyous rhythmic chant.
Anahi, 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 Anahi. Anahi, 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 Anahi. Anahi, 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 Anahi.
I don't know anything more joyous than that. I mean, that's kind of fun to sing as well. I wasn't expecting that kind of rhythm and excitement and energy, and that's what you've got there in these chants on your website.
Well, the sweet voice is that of cantor Kathy Robbins, and the little narration at the beginning is my holy wife, Ellen Kaufman Dussek.
And who's playing the piano?
Sky Ladd, brilliant young musician.
Well, first of all, because I am so into sound, it's very well produced. It's like I am not just, and this is, by the way, this kind of goes to another issue as well. I, especially working for the Christian station, and a lot of the people didn't have a ton of money, but they had enough to buy the airtime, and they would come in with these cassettes, which is what we were using back then. And some of the stuff that I was listening to was like, boy, this is really hard to hear. So I would do everything I could to enhance it a little bit. I could never take out certain things they wanted to take out, and the hums and things that I could emphasize and de-emphasize, as I would describe it. But the message that I was always wanting to get across to the programmers was that your message is important. What you have to say is important. Whether I agree or disagree is irrelevant. My purpose here at this station is to get your message to the public so they can make up their own minds. And if they are distracted by the sound quality, then you've already lost. So let's work on improving the quality of your message so that the listener can make up his or her own mind. I don't have any distraction when I listen to this. And this is really kind of cool. I think this is really a neat opportunity for people to have something like this to go to. Again, the title of the book, my guest, of course, is the author, Rabbi Wayne Dussek, and the title of the book is The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. I know that you obviously you come from a Jewish background and tradition, and I come from a predominantly Catholic Western rite of the Catholic Church. But I was privileged in my first marriage to be introduced to what is referred to as the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church, the Byzantine Rite, that many people would say, oh, must be Greek Orthodox. I said, no, they're as much under the Pope as the West is. This church was started in Byzantium, which became Constantinople, and so on and so on and so on. And the chanting, the cantors, especially around the holidays, I just fell in love with that. It was such a wonderful experience. The incense and the candles, the ceremony, the ritual, the tradition that goes into that. Whether it's misplaced or not is irrelevant. The fact is, we've lost a lot when we start setting aside a lot of the ritual and the ceremony, the rites. I have to say that the Jewish community, at least not in the West, but in Israel and the Middle East, I don't know this for a fact. I don't want to speak out of turn here. But when you have a bar mitzvah for a boy to become a man, and I'm sure that this is the way that it was for thousands of years, for hundreds of years, the community treated that 13-year-old post-bar mitzvah as a man. But in the West, here in our day, the bar mitzvah is just kind of a thing that you do, it seems, but that it's still a 13-year-old boy.
Well, I've often advocated that we move the bar mitzvah to 16 when the kid gets a driver's license, and we call it a car mitzvah.
But, I mean, my question has always been, when does a male become a man? Is it at 16 when they get their license? Is it at 18 when they can vote? Is it at 21 when they can drink? Is it at their first sexual experience? Is it whatever the moment is? And
you know what Freud said?
What's that?
Freud said a man isn't a man until his father dies.
Really?
Yeah.
My dad is 81 years old, be
he
82 this year.
Well.
Yeah. And I if that's the case, I hope I don't become a man until my father is 100.
Amen. Absolutely. Amen. But it really is always an interesting question. And, the goalposts change all the time.
Yeah.
And this new young generation, we hardly understand it, but it's taking over the world. So.
Yeah. Well, I remember an experience, and I created this men's group back in the early 90s, and we used as our base text Robert Bly's Iron John.
Right.
And what we decided, instead of sitting around on the patio just reading and talking and talking and reading, we decided we'd start taking hikes.
Uh-huh.
And then we started to do camping trips. And uh-huh. This one particular trip, I had an experience, and I was at the age of 33, I had this experience with this other gentleman where we got into a little bit of a tiff, and I'd had enough. I mean, I grew up in a family of eight. I knew how to wash dishes, and we were at this campsite, and he was now trying to tell me how I should be washing the dishes. And I said, that's it. I'm done. I walked away, and I kind of exploded a little bit, and he had a reaction to that. And he came up the hill and to talk to me, because that's where I decided I'm just going to go up the hill and I'm going to sit for a little while and cool off. And he comes up and I said, look, you're not my dad and you're not my professor. You are by far not my mentor, although I've rethought that a little bit because he did teach me some things. But it was that experience for me where I stood up for myself really for probably the first time in my life. And I remember sharing this with my mother and family at the dinner table one evening when we all got together for a holiday or something. And I said, I've always been asking the question about, when does a boy become a man? And I said that what I found is my experience was when I was 33 and that was it. And my mother's reaction at that time was, well, it's about time. But
yeah, mothers are like that. My mother should rest in peace. But she was still alive when I got some of the blurbs for this book. One came from Dr. David Ellenson, Rabbi Dr. David Ellenson, who's the president of the Hebrew Union College, the president of the Reform Seminary, campuses in New York, Cincinnati, Los Angeles, and Jerusalem, one of the most respected scholars and administrators in the entire Jewish world. And David Ellenson writes, with this book, Rabbi Dasik proves himself to be a spiritual master of our time. Now, that's a pretty nice thing to say.
That's pretty
so
nice.
So I call up my late mother, she was obviously still alive, and I say, Ma, listen to this. David Ellenson wrote this blurb, and I read it to her. She says to me, did you get any blurbs from people who aren't already your friends?
Well, I was going to start referring to you as an oracle, but I don't know.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, it seems to me...
I answer to anything. You can imagine what they called me in gym and, when I was a kid.
Yes, I can only imagine, and we won't go there on this program. But, I went through the same kinds of things. And when I was in grade school and high school, fortunately, it tapered off in high school as I got older. And then, of course, there was none of that in college. But it still was a rather impactful experience that probably has sent me into a direction that I never thought would happen, because I've had other friends who went through similar experiences in their grade school and high schools, and they became introverts. So I just say, bully on you, the bullies in my school that did what they did because you helped me. And it's kind of weird to admit that the people who have that kind of pushed our buttons as we were growing up actually facilitated us becoming the people that we are. And so to turn to them and say, thank you, kind of weird.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to do, because that brings us closer and closer to each other, closer and closer to the understanding that we are all children of God.
Exactly. Before we wrap up the program, I have three more questions for you that I will not ask in a confluence. I will ask them one at a time.
Okay.
Because I have to tell you that I've been asking these now for the last couple of 3 years of my guests, and I love the reactions.
Okay.
First question. Who is Wayne Dasik?
Wayne Dasik is a child of God, a child of the universe. He is a husband, a father, a grandfather, a spiritual guide and healer, and a baseball fan who has been rooting for the Cubs all his life, thus knowing the meaning of the biblical phrase, long forbearing and abundant in kindness.
The 40 years in the desert by the Israelis in the Old Testament.
Yeah,
wasn't
we're going over 100 with the Cubs.
Yes, exactly. And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I hope that the world will come to learn the name of God. The name of God is Anochi, and that the world will come together in oneness consciousness of that name and of the reality. There is one God, one world, one people, and we will work to bring Eden on earth once again.
And speaking of people, how powerful are we?
Oh, infinitely powerful. We can do anything that we want. I'll tell you, except... So I'll tell you this last story, and that is that a number of scientists came to God, and they said, God, we love you, we respect you, we honor you, but we've come to say goodbye to you. And God said, really, why? And the scientists said, well, because the only thing that you can do that we can't do is create ex nihilo, out of nothing. So you create human beings ex nihilo. But in our scientific explorations, we've learned to do that. We can do that now, so we don't need you anymore. We've come to say goodbye. And God said, really? Please show me. And the scientist reached down and picked up a clump of earth and started to mold it and shape it and form it. And God said, use your own dirt.
Oh, wow.
But we can be co-creative partners with God in making this a just and a peaceful world. Do you have time for one more story?
I absolutely do.
So I grew up in the southeast side of Chicago. Bad, bad Leroy Brown and me, same neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1945, it was a Polish Catholic steelworkers neighborhood. In 1960, it was a half-Jewish neighborhood. And in 1970, it was a totally black neighborhood. same middle-class neighborhood, same middle-class kind of inhabitants, but a total change in demography over the years. When I was a little kid, late 40s, the early 50s, we all played together on the playground. Then I went to public school, and some of the kids went to St. Mary Magdalene's, the local Catholic church parochial school. By the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I was being beaten up on a regular basis by my former friends who had learned from their priests and their nuns that I, Wayne Dossick, had personally killed their Lord. Fast forward to 40 or some years, I am a rabbi and a faculty of a Catholic university teaching the only courses in Jewish studies in the Department of Religion and Theological Studies, working with the late and now much lamented Monsignor from Mission and Ministry to create an all-faith service for the church on campus once a year where people from every faith, Jews, Catholics, Protestants, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Eastern religion folks, Native Americans, came to pray for peace and goodwill with each other. I myself preach from the pulpit of the Immaculata, standing next to a statue of Jesus, and one of my closest friends in the whole world is a Jesuit priest. Look at how far we've come. Look what we human beings can do, if only we set our minds and our hearts to do it. Back in 1987, a whole bunch of us around the world stood holding hands and singing songs. It was called the Harmonic Convergence, remember?
Mm-hmm. I do remember.
And everybody laughed at us. Mm-hmm. They laughed at us saying, oh, what do you think, you kids holding, I wasn't such a kid then, but holding hands and singing songs, you think it's going to change the world? Well, if I had told you in 1986, a year before the Harmonic Convergence, that my prediction would be that in the next 20 years, the Soviet Union would fall and communism would die in the Soviet Union, all the Soviet satellite countries would become to one extent or another democratic, the Berlin Wall would fall, blacks and whites would be riding buses together in South Africa, Protestants and Catholics would stop shooting each other in Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. and once in a while, Jews and Arabs would sit down at a peace table. You would have called me totally crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You would have called the white coats to cart me away.
Yeah.
But it all happened. And it all happened because human beings put our hearts and our minds to put out that kind of oneness conscious energy. And that is what we can do. We can make this world a great place, a wonderful place. Now, again, oneness does not mean sameness. Father O'Leary doesn't want me to be Catholic, and I don't want him to be Jewish. We respect, we honor the different pathways we all create, the different journeys we all take. But the beginning place and the end place are all the same, from God to God.
Mm-hmm.
And if the more aware we are, the more conscious we are of God in our lives, of God's message of oneness, of God's message of love, the more and more we can change this world and bring this world to decency and dignity and harmony and tranquility and justice and love and peace.
Besides, as a Catholic, I've learned too well how to suffer, and you've, as a Jew, have learned too well how to be guilty. So we will just leave it at that and stay in our respective corners and still enjoy our each other's company and the message that that you bring. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your time, your story, yourself with us here on the program.
It's a great pleasure. And thank you for being such an incredibly thinking and the feeling interviewer. It's a wonderful, wonderful program you have made so because of the depth of your learning and the depth of your questions.
Well, thank you so much. Before I go, I wanted to share with you something, and that is that some years ago, and this was when I was at the Christian Station, I was working through a lot of the dogma and doctrine that was being pumped out, you know, both from my Catholicism but also from the Station. And I was starting to pull away from some of it because some of it made absolutely no logical sense whatsoever. But I had come to this one conclusion that if, in fact, there is a day of judgment where I will stand before God, someone asked me, so, well, what would you say? What would you say when you stood before God? And I had actually been thinking about that. And so this is my answer to them. I said, okay, God created everything. God is everything, if you will. And I'd say, okay, God, Anochi, you gave me this life and I did the very best that I could with it. Okay. Now you're going to do with me what you're going to do with me, no matter what I say here, because my actions in the previous life, they bear the fruit that they've borne. And so you're going to do with me what you will, but because you created everything, including me, and you knew everything that was going to happen, this is on you, not me. And they just looked at me with incredulity, and I said, well, wait a minute. Why is that so wrong? If you know, either we are 100% responsible for our lives, i.e., God, I did the best I could with what you gave me. I lived the life that there's a poem that I remember reading a couple of programs back about how life is not to be lived safely and securely in this little place and to where no harm comes to you. You should actually go sliding into death with a body that is worn out and you're yelling, Yahoo! And in one hand you have this thing, you have a box of chocolates, and in the other hand you have a glass of wine and said, man, what a ride, I want to go again. And from that standpoint, I say, then why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we living our lives, living our purposes, and going out completely worn out? Because guess what? They say there's plenty of time to sleep in the next life, as it were. At least that's the theory. Anyway, now is not the time to sleep. Now is the time to live.
Well, Richard, you'll have to have me back for an entire program because I know that you have time limits here. But what you are talking about in your response to God is the age-old question of determinism versus free will.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how that's handled. And so you have to remember that while God may have determined the greater blueprint, mm-hmm. you also have total free will.
Yeah.
And so it's the old, I think it's the Buddhist image of you're tied to a long, long rope. A donkey's tied to the other end. The donkey's going straight ahead. Eventually, the donkey will get over the finish line. But meanwhile, you have enough rope to go left, right, straight, to sit for a while, to mm-hmm. get up, to mm-hmm. climb a tree. You have plenty of choices along the way. What I want to know from God is, could I see the movies of my parallel life if I had chosen a different way? What if I had said yes instead of no? What if I had turned left instead of right? What if I had said yes to this woman and no to that woman? What if I had chosen this job and not that job? I want to see what would have happened had I made the different free will choices.
Yeah. Remember that movie with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. What
And my friend, don't worry about God's judgment. God is not there to judge.
Right.
God is not a harsh judge. God, what happens when you go to the other side is that you have a life review. And much like that movie,
mm-hmm.
and in that life review, you can work on your eternal soul can work on the issues that you may have not been so happy with in this life, and do their karmic fixing, so that when your soul returns in another incarnation, you won't have to deal with those issues again.
Mm. The book is entitled The Real Name of God. My guest has been Rabbi Wayne Dossick. Thank you once again for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
If you're just curious as to if there's more to this interview following the radio broadcast, there is. There is more following the A to Zen broadcast. So go to richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and listen to the entirety of this program. You're going to love it. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this time, love Talal.